reality in a polarized world. The 31-year-old artist tries to convey his message of togetherness in his movement called Beyond Walls. The project consists of frescoes depicting two hands clasping each other's forearms around the world. South Africa's Cape Town represents an essential step of the project due to its history marked by apartheid. The self-taught artist says he wants to create the biggest human chain in the world, and Cape Town is his ninth step.
Because for me, I really trust that it's only together that humanity can respond to the biggest challenge of our time. And this is this message that I want to do by making huge fresco with beautiful paint directly on the grass. It is a worldwide project, and the idea is to create the biggest human chain to speak about togetherness. And today in Cape Town, this is the ninth step of this project.
Saib uses paint made out of charcoal, chalk, water and milk proteins to create his art, making it eco-friendly. He was also named one of the most influential young artists by Forbes magazine for his art, which is best viewed from aerial footage. His temporary biodegradable images have been previously painted on lawns in 8 cities, including Paris, Andorra, Geneva, Berlin, Ouagadougou, and Istanbul.
A Russian firm has developed a flying taxi in an attempt to solve the problem of transportation in megacities. According to HoverSurf company, testing the aircraft is now in the final stages. If successful, the drone taxi will go into mass production at the end of 2021. Special runways are not required as the vehicle is as big as a normal car and can land on a parking lot. Designers say it's capable of carrying 2 people or up to 300 kilograms of cargo.
The prototype of this flying machine will soon turn into a social device that we're going to build in 2021, and thus all the technologies that we have already built will be applied to this machine. The car will fly with a new type of engine that is installed here.
The flying taxi can reach an altitude of 150 meters and develop a speed of up to 200 kilometers per hour. The company says a flight with air taxi will cost around 27 cents per kilometer. The name Afghanistan may remind many people across the world of some bad news or war, violence and poverty. This is mainly due to the war in Afghanistan, which has been going on for over the past decades. Yet there are some interesting stories about Afghanistan, its people and their traditions and customs, such as Afghans' food culture. Amin Alami has more in this report.
When it comes to cooking and traditional dishes, Afghans have a lot to say. First of all, this is important to know that meat and rice are inseparable parts of Afghan's food culture.
Afghan traditional dishes like qabili, kebab, karai, mantu, ashak, bulani and dugh are the some you can find available in restaurants, mainly serving traditional delicacies. Each one of these represents the food culture of specific tribes and ethnic groups.
Let's see what the manager of this restaurant has to say about some popular local dishes in Afghanistan.
When you want to talk about traditional foods of Afghanistan, you need to test different dishes that are, of course, very delicious. For instance, qabili is a mixture of rice, carrot, cuisine, and lamb meat. Northern Afghanistan is home to this delicious food, while Western Herat province is well known for its delicious khichdi.
There are some key factors which should be taken into consideration when talking about Afghan food culture. As Afghans themselves say, their food is highly organic. They believe the food culture has made Afghans' bodies much stronger than those who do not have organic meals and their food culture.
We can't leave out meat from cooking. Additionally, our food culture is based on using organic products. This has even helped us have a stronger body.
As there is a wide variety of delicious dishes here, the good news is that the prices are not high. For example, you can serve a complete lunch menu at one of the top restaurants in Kabul by spending at most $15.
If you compare food prices in Afghanistan and other countries, you will find out that you can have the best dish in a top restaurant in Afghanistan by paying less than $20. The quality of food in our country is also better.
As observers say, Afghanistan has many capabilities and interesting attractions to be truly introduced for the globe if the war and politics allow this wounded land to breathe. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
After nearly 3 years of conservation efforts, a group of newborn leaf monkeys have been recently spotted in southwest China. The rare monkeys, which fall under China's first-class national protection program, were spotted earlier this month in Mangshi City in Yunnan province. The baby monkeys sport golden fur, which will gradually turn gray when they are about 3 months old. Forest keepers have been noting an increase in the number of monkeys and expect their population to continue growing as biodiversity is improving.
Since the beginning of this year, we have spotted 11 little golden monkeys and several pregnant adult monkeys. It can be estimated that the number of these golden newborns will increase to around 20 by April.
Leaf monkeys are spread across western Yunnan as well as in eastern and northern Myanmar. Over the past few years, Yunnan's local government has strengthened protection for the animals. It's estimated there are now approximately 400 leaf monkeys in Mangshi.
Scientists have discovered a 20-million-year-old fossilized tree with intact branches and roots on the Greek island of Lesbos. The 19-meter-long tree was found near a petrified forest formed millions of years ago by a volcanic eruption. A thick layer of ash had preserved the tree. Since excavations began 25 years ago, this is the first time a tree in such proper condition has been uncovered in the area. Experts have been studying the unique forest to gather information of plants and animals and to reconstruct the ecosystem that existed 20 million years ago.
In Slovenia, two climbers have dared to scale Europe's tallest chimney. Janja Granbrej and Damen Skofic managed to complete the challenge in 7 hours and 32 minutes. They described the experience as the most difficult one in their professional lives. The 360-meter-high tower at the Trebevil power station is located in eastern Slovenia. It is known as the world's longest artificial multi-pitch climbing route.
Oh, isn't this sweet? A baby panda gluing to a zookeeper's leg has grabbed attention on social media, with her video receiving at least 4 million hits on YouTube alone. 6 months old Fu Bao lives in a South Korean zoo. Her video went viral, showing the cub gripping her keeper's leg during a regular checkup. The cute panda refused to let the keeper go, even when he tried to walk away. Fu Bao is the first giant panda born in South Korea. Her parents arrived in the country in 2016 as part of China's panda diplomacy. Fu Bao has received enormous attention since her birth, with her videos posted on the zoo's social media. Elephants at a zoo in the U.S. state of Arizona have enjoyed a rare snowy day, romping joyfully under the white flurry. While most of animals in Ride Park Zoo cozied up in the warmth, the elephants could not resist the snowfall in the sun-kissed state. They stayed out, with baby elephants splashing in their enclosure's pond and rolling in the mud. The baby elephants saw the snowfall for the first time in their life. Frosty flakes made their way to Arizona on Tuesday. That was a surprise for many in the U.S. West, which is plagued by drought.
That's it for the light. Thank you.
Epic. Epic. Glory. Honor. Honor. This is Bahman, the month which reminds us of love and empathy.
Amrikom, Amrikom, nan kene rangetom, in the limelight.
A government agency known as the Congressional Watchdog has issued a new report recently shedding more light on the Trump administration's failed response to the raging coronavirus pandemic. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Jessica Corbett, writer. This article is published under the heading, New Government Report Details How Trump Failed COVID-19 Response Across the Board. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. A U.S. government agency known as the Congressional Watchdog has issued a new report recently shedding more light on the Trump administration's failed response to the raging coronavirus pandemic. Over 430,000 Americans had died from COVID-19 by Thursday, January 28, and the country's hospitalizations, though falling, have still topped 100,000 every day this month. The report released on Thursday, January 28, by the Government Accountability Office, GAO, entitled COVID-19, Critical Vaccine Distribution, Supply Chain, Program Integrity, and Other Challenges Require Focused Federal Attention, is the fifth agency analysis of the March 2020 Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economic Security CARES Act. The findings alarmed key lawmakers, including Representative James E. Clyburn, House Majority Whip and Chairman of the Select Subcommittee on the Coronavirus Crisis. As Clyburn put it, today's alarming report from the Government Accountability Office provides further confirmation of what the Select Subcommittee's investigations have made clear. The previous administration's coronavirus response failed across the board, exacerbating the pandemic's toll of death, disease, and economic harm. The report illustrates how the response was ineffective, lacking a comprehensive testing strategy, and failing to address medical supply shortages, inefficient, bungling the initial stages of vaccine distribution, and equitable, failing to protect workers and leaving federal relief programs vulnerable to significant risk of fraudulent activities, Clyburn said in a statement. Perhaps most disturbingly, the Majority Whip added, today's report revealed that even after GAO made 27 different recommendations aimed at improving the response, the Trump administration failed to implement them. That means only 4 of 31 GAO recommendations have been implemented. GAO remains deeply troubled that agencies have not acted on recommendations to more fully address critical gaps in the medical supply chain, the report says. While GAO recognizes federal agencies continue to take some steps, GAO underscores the importance of developing a well-formulated plan to address critical gaps for the remainder of the pandemic, especially in the light of the recent surge in cases. The former U.S. administration's refusal to act on the agency's recommendations also drew criticism from Benny G. Thompson, chairman of the House Committee on Homeland Security, who said that this report confirms what we already knew. The Trump administration failed to take any meaningful action to improve the federal response to the COVID-19 pandemic during its final month. It's inaction to address critical weaknesses that GAO previously identified including developing clear and comprehensive plans for testing and vaccine distribution, likely cost lives and created an even bigger mess for the new administration, he added. Clyburn's office highlighted some major findings from the report: that vaccine distribution under President Donald Trump fell short of expectations, as well as his administration's failure to address critical gaps in the medical supply chain or fraudulent activity related to corporate relief programs. Implementation of GAO's recommendation concerning the importance of clear and comprehensive vaccine distribution and communication plans remains a work in progress, the report says. Moreover, slow implementation of GAO's recommendations relating to program integrity, in particular those made to the Small Business Administration and Department of Labor, creates risk of considerable improper payments, including those related to fraud, and falls far short of transparency and accountability expectations. The report urges the new Democrat-controlled Congress and administration to act on not only the previously ignored recommendations, but also 13 new ones. GAO is pleased that the Consolidated Appropriations Act 2021, enacted in December of 2020, requires a number of actions that are consistent with several of GAO's prior recommendations, including those related to the medical supply chain, vaccines and therapeutics, and COVID-19 testing, the agency adds. GAO will monitor the implementation of the Act's requirements. Thompson expressed hope that the new president will, as he promised on the campaign trail, pursue a more effective COVID-19 agenda. It's tragic. It will take a year and over 400,000 American lives lost for the federal government to take substantive action to take this pandemic seriously.
The coronavirus pandemic has become an endless nightmare for much of the world. Despite the development and distribution of a range of new vaccines, many countries are still struggling to battle the deadly waves of the highly transmissible disease. As the world steps up efforts to contain the deadly virus, new variants are rapidly replacing older versions, making the situation even more frightening. Many thousands of people lose their lives every day worldwide, despite restrictive measures that have paralyzed economies. The pandemic could get much worse before it gets better. The world is undoubtedly eager to find out how the whole thing began so that future risks can be minimized. The origin of COVID-19 has been a major bone of contention, especially between the world's worst coronavirus-hit country, the United States, and China, where the deadly virus was first detected in December 2019. The two sides have exchanged barbs over the origin of the crisis. Now all eyes are focused on a fact-finding mission on the origins of the pandemic. A team of scientists from the World Health Organization is right now in the Chinese city of Wuhan trying to find out the origins of the outbreak. The WHO says its fact-finding mission in Wuhan is purely scientific, but the probe is facing a political minefield. The World Health Organization team will carry out on-the-ground investigations into the source of the new coronavirus. The WHO scientists will visit different places in Wuhan and talk to people and officials. The WHO says all hypotheses are on the table during the probe. The WHO team is expected to inspect a seafood market in Wuhan, which was linked to many of the first COVID-19 cases in December 2019. The scientists will also visit hospitals that treat coronavirus patients in the city. But how much will the team of investigators be able to uncover? The WHO experts face a tough task as the city has been repeatedly disinfected. The investigation is ongoing in Wuhan, but there have been cautions against expecting any breakthroughs soon. It could take years before any firm conclusions can be reached. What's making the WHO mission even tougher is the fact that it has been highly politicized. Several countries, particularly the United States, accuse the Chinese government of hiding the outbreak's severity during its early stages. The administration of former U.S. President Donald Trump kept criticizing China for alleged failures in containing the outbreak and refusing to tell the truth. The WHO itself was branded by Trump as a, quote, puppet of China. The Chinese government has dismissed Western allegations, saying the virus might have begun outside of China. Trump is now gone, but the White House is keeping up pressure on Beijing. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki expressed concern this week about what she called misinformation coming out of China. Beijing has warned against any negative speculation and politicized interpretation of the fact-finding mission. Will the WHO scientists be able to carry out their investigation properly despite all the political pressure?
Obviously, the scientific medical investigation may help for future prevention or development of science in terms of understanding how viruses change and how the pandemic started and how the new virus originated. Obviously, among scientists, or at least the majority of scientists, believe what happened is a natural mutation of the virus.
Observers believe that the scientists should be allowed to complete their work independently because the results could prove vital for the future of mankind.
Was planned by the Dutch government as a system to prevent the rapid spread of the COVID-19 virus in the Netherlands has turned sour, as it seems that the curfew imposed has been met with staunch opposition, with four nights of rioting taking place across the country, causing shops to be looted, infrastructure to be damaged, and police having to react to contain the disturbance. With police facing rioters on the front line, water cannons, CS gas, and other forms of police force have had to be deployed, resulting in hundreds of arrests being made and fines allocated to those who break the curfew rules. Yet it seems after four nights of violence involving a crowd formed by a majority of youths, the police have managed to take hold of the situation as protests have died down as the consequences of the actions of the rioters are being met with a tough stance by the police and the government. In fact, the reaction by the Dutch government is one of anger as it claims that all damage will be paid for by those responsible. A tough task to apply, but something that the government of Mark Rutte is keen to go through with, as echoed by the Dutch finance minister, who has labelled the rioters as scum. Many of the protests and rioters are complaining about the measures being taken by the Dutch government when it comes to containing and dealing with the virus, claiming a curfew still does not eradicate the virus. But many in the Netherlands do not agree with the protests, stating that only a small minority of people are causing so much trouble.
Well, we're very sorry about it. It's just really unfortunate, actually. I have a feeling that most of these people, not all of them, some are genuine protesters against corona rules, right? But most of them are just people who usually attend football matches and just are looking for rioting, etc. And that's really unfortunate. I mean, that's just not what all of the Netherlands is. I mean, this is just like 0.1% of population, or maybe 0.01% of population. It's very unfortunate that it gets such a lot of international attention.
With a country very much like the rest of Europe, impatient to get the vaccines rolled out, hence allowing life to return to some kind of normality, It remains to be seen what will happen until then. However, deep in the mix of the protests, yet still visible enough to be seen, it seems that the protests and riots are a stage for another form of demonstration in the Netherlands, one that may yet again rise its ugly head in the near future. Many countries across the world have seen the effects of the pandemic affect their social well-being, causing many people to reach boiling point, as over 12 months of hardship has seen the world change the way it performs, even the most benign of duties. Yet worryingly, in the Netherlands, pockets of protests have included political groups, which most concerning of all, contain far-right movements, with evidence suggesting that the Dutch branch of the German-born Pegida ideology has been counted amongst the protesters. The Netherlands has a strong far-right influence in its political parties, and this has been reflected by some far-right politicians calling on the Dutch military to step in and protect the streets of the country against the rioters, something that suggests the current plan to control the situation by the police may just not be enough, in spite of a calmer last day or two. But the Netherlands, as we know, has a strong anti-immigrant and in particular anti-Muslim following, inspired by the likes of far-right leader Geert Wilders, who in his past rhetoric has made his feelings very clear about certain communities living in the country.
Look at the Islamization of our country. If a Dutch person driving in a car drives 5 miles too fast, he will be fined within a minute. Whereas the Moroccan scum in Holland, and once again, not all are scum, but there is a lot of Moroccan scum in Holland who makes the streets unsafe, mostly young people. And they are not taken seriously. We are making them and the people unsafe, and this should change.
With far-right groups such as Pediger now emerging in the shadows of the protests, could this openly public sentiment fall into the hands of far-right leaders, such as Geert Wilders, who may use the surge in feelings to fuel his campaign to bring the far-right up another notch on the political spectrum, especially as the Dutch are due to face an upcoming election following the resignation of current Prime Minister Mark Rutte following a welfare payment scandal. There's no doubt that far-right groups across Europe are still very much in place, and although the COVID-19 virus has played its part on diverting attention away from politics for now, could the example seen in the Dutch protests and riots be the catalyst for other far-right groups in Europe to jump on the bandwagon and politicise the virus to their own benefits?
January 26th is remembered by many Australians as a national day, with many celebrating the occasion with pomp and show to mark the anniversary of the 1788 arrival of a group of British ships called the First Fleet at Port Jackson in New South Wales and the raising of the British flag at Sydney Cove by Arthur Phillip. The part of the celebrations was hoisting an Australian flag over Sydney's Opera House and displaying the word Austay on the sky over the Sydney Harbour. But the celebrations of the origins of a modern nation are a time of mourning for Indigenous Australians who have endured discriminations despite inhabiting the land for centuries. They view the arrival of British settlers 200 years ago as the beginning of pain and suffering. They even brand the Australia Day as Invasions Day. That's why thousands of people, mainly Indigenous, defied coronavirus restrictions on Tuesday and took to the streets in several cities to highlight their plight. Some protesters chanted a slogan such as "Sovereignty was never ceded" and "No justice, no peace," while others held up placards reading "Not a day to celebrate" and "Black lives matter."
It's very important because the issues that we're facing here in Australia are not going to go away overnight. So until we start getting justice and start seeing change in this country, we will not stop. This will be continuous. We no longer call it Australia Day, it's now Invasion Day. Always was and always will be Invasion Day.
But why do Indigenous Australians view this auspicious day as Invasions Day?
There's a much wider recognition these days of the 26th of January as an invasion day or a survival day, because at least for the last generation or so, younger people have learned that the colonisation of this country was not simply a matter of settlement. It was a matter of brutal dispossession. It was a matter of genocide. It was a matter of trying to obliterate the culture of Indigenous people here. And at least for the last 30 or so years, there's been a recognition every year and some greater recognition in schools and universities of that sort of history. So there is now, as a result, this very strong tension between the ongoing celebration of colonisation called Australia Day and the recognition of survival or Invasion Day, which is an important educative influence over younger people in this country.
Australia Day, which was formally declared a national holiday only in 1994, has increasingly heightened heated debates in recent years. The occasion is staunchly defended by right-wing commentators and retains strong support from the country's conservative government. Prime Minister Scott Morrison believes history changed forever in 1788 and that there was no escaping or cancelling that fact. He says for the better and worse, it was the moment where the journey to modern Australia began. But federal opposition leader Anthony Albanese has a totally different reading of the whole historical journey. This is Australia Day, is the one Australians need to acknowledge that it has been a very difficult day for the First Nations people.
In the first instance, it's important for us to recognise our own history and the consequences of our own history and the fallout of that colonisation and dispossession and the way in which the non-Aboriginal communities benefited from that and still benefit from that and the ongoing enormous social advantage against Indigenous people in this country, which far outweighs that of any other community. So if we don't understand our own history, we can't have a resolution of contemporary problems. Secondly, because Australia is involved in a lot of adventures, a lot of neocolonial adventures in other countries, we can't recognise the problems of that and the problems of our own intervention in other countries unless we understand our own history and the colonisation of our own history.
Australia's Aboriginals currently represent around 3% of the country's population, but the most disadvantaged lot of the society. They are also said to be largely excluded in their limited capacity to participate in the decision-making or even control their own and mainstream social and cultural environment. From forcible separation of children from their families to their being displaced from their land, limited education and inadequate employment, discrimination has been widely recorded by advocacy groups. But how has the Australian Indigenous population been marginalised even to the present day?
Well, there's been enormous disadvantage. It occurs across the board. For example, Aboriginal people in prison are something like 14 to 15 times overrepresented. In education, there's been enormous disadvantage. In health, there's terrible disadvantage. As I said, there's no other group, no other ethnic group or community that is nearly as disadvantaged as Aboriginal people, despite the fact that large amounts of money have been spent on particular programs, but they haven't achieved success because there's a very deep cultural alienation, for example, from the institutions and the educational institutions of Australia.
All in all, what needs to be done is for the Australian government to put an end to the misery of the Indigenous people and take steps to make it not look like they're from another planet.
It's very rare that a former leader publicly criticises or provides advice to his or her successor, and is often something that protocol frowns upon when it's done. However, this has not stopped the former Labour Chancellor and Prime Minister Gordon Brown from doing so, leaving Boris Johnson red-faced in the process. So intense has the criticism been that Gordon Brown has stated that Britain is becoming a failed state, not only through the poor mishandling of various crises by the British government, but also because of the ever-widening and deepening divisions within the British socio-political system. It seems that Brown has placed the blame squarely at the feet of Boris Johnson, suggesting that the Prime Minister is so alienated from the reality in which British people are living that he has lost scope of how British feel on a variety of issues and everyday problems. One of the main reasons for the disparity is the divide between the Conservative Party and the people, a division that's traditionally seen different classes voting for different parties in the UK, with the working class commonly leaning towards Labour and the upper middle class swinging towards the Tories, hence leading to a lack of communication between the ruling party and the majority of people in Britain. One such example of just how divided the UK are as a population is the opinion on Brexit. With such a slim divide between those wishing to leave the EU and remain, the difference of opinion of people across the whole of the United Kingdom of Great Britain and the north of Ireland is already fractured, without raising the notion of nationalism and separatism into the equation. So when the element of nationalism is introduced into the argument, for example, in the case of Scotland, Is former Prime Minister Gordon Brown right when he says that the UK is on the verge of becoming a failed state? And if so, just how serious is the problem?
It's obvious that the present system isn't working. When you have one of the constituent nations, Scotland and the other, completely at odds with the capital and the sort of the economic core of the country, then it's obviously the system is not working. A political system hasn't just to represent a numerical majority. It has to represent all sectors of society and all regions of a country. And this current system is obviously failing to do so.
Back in 2014, the majority of Scots rejected the idea of having an independent Scotland, for the country was benefiting from EU budgets allocated to its agriculture, economy and education sectors. However, now that Britain has left the EU, Scots see themselves empty-handed and are highly considering rejoining the EU once again. Scottish First Minister Nicola Sturgeon has repeatedly stated that she would push for a second referendum if her party wins a majority in May elections. Sturgeon has insisted on her country's political independence by stating that Westminster's consent to the move is not their priority, for it's for the people of Scotland to choose and not the lawmakers in Westminster. Latest poll shows that nearly half of the people in Scotland are now in favour of an independent country, a figure that's likely to increase even more as Scots see less benefits flow into their country, and Scottish nationalism is significantly on the rise, hence putting the Scottish people much closer to the option of voting for such a move.
Well, yes, because the last referendum they had was under completely different circumstances. Britain was part of the European Union. Scotland and the Scots were very happy Europeans, and they liked it that way. When Britain left the European Union, they were left, defenceless and without allies in the face of an overweening London capital. So, yeah, they're entitled to ask for it. Whether they should get it or not, is another story. Once the time comes, vote for independence.
Some of the problems that Britain is struggling with in its post-Brexit era and the widening political and social inequality have encouraged other countries within the UK to consider leaving, for they believe that they're better off on their own. Current polls indicate that over half the people of the north of Ireland welcome the idea of holding a referendum on a united Ireland. Also in Wales, people are starting to back the idea of holding a referendum on independence, spelling the inevitable breakup of the United Kingdom in the process. Can Boris Johnson's Conservative government, therefore, reunite a divided Britain? Or has the pendulum swung too far past the tipping point, taking Britain towards a collapsed failed state full of internal division?
What you heard was an IRIB English radio programme. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Just before the 2020 presidential vote, the Saudi embassy in Washington hired Off-Hill Strategies, a firm with a long history in conservative politics, for $75,000 to lobby for them through January of 2021. The article we're about to present you has been written by Marcus Barham. The piece is titled, Saudi Arabia Hires Over a Dozen Lobbying Firms in U.S. to Launder Its Reputation. The article has been taken from the foreignpolicy.com website. Please stay with us for more of Marcus Barham's article. Saudi authorities have reportedly hired more than a dozen lobbying firms to help boost relations with the United States of America and improve the Riyadh regime's image in the United States as new President Joe Biden assumes office. According to foreign agent registration filings with the U.S. Justice Department, Riyadh has used at least 16 firms to largely restore its influence machine in the capital, Washington, and in other parts of the country, and help boost U.S.-Saudi trade relations. A foreign policy report said the lobbying effort will be even more crucial during the term of the new U.S. President Joe Biden, whose administration decided recently to freeze arms sales to Riyadh pending a review. Saudi authorities are already in hot water over issues including Riyadh's devastating war in neighboring Yemen, its treatment of women, and the murder of the exiled Saudi dissident and journalist Jamal Khashoggi inside the Saudi consulate building in Istanbul, Turkey in 2018. The report said foreign agents hired to lobby on behalf of Saudi interests have apparently contributed almost $2 million in political donations to federal candidates, including to Donald Trump and to the new president, Joe Biden. Among these firms is the powerhouse Edelman, which heavily favors Democratic candidates in its political donations and signed a $225,000 contract after the November presidential election to provide services to the controversial NEOM megacity project that is planned to be constructed in Tabuk region of northwestern Saudi Arabia on the Red Sea in an area nearly the size of Belgium. The Israeli regime's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman reportedly held a secret meeting in NEOM City in late November last year. Edelman Communications firm was also hired by state-owned Saudi Basic Industries in early 2020 to provide strategic communications in a $5.6 million contract. Additionally, the Riyadh regime struck deals with companies seen as close to the Republican Party. Just before the presidential vote in November, the Saudi embassy in Washington hired Off-Hill Strategies, a firm run by a couple with a long history in conservative politics, for $75,000 to lobby for the Saudis through to January 2021. Ben Freeman of the Center of International Policy's Foreign Influence Transparency Initiative, which seeks to promote transparency and accountability in global relations, said the Saudis need to maintain their influence within the Republican Party post-Donald Trump in hope that the Republican Senate can help block any bills that might hurt them, like prohibitions on arms sales or withdrawing their occupation forces from neighboring Yemen. He added, there was this public perception that the Saudi lobby went into hiding following Jamal Khashoggi's murder. Ben Freeman added, but that's not true at all. What we saw is that actually they doubled down, giving money to think tanks and U.S. universities to help launder their reputation. Ben Freeman noted that the Saudi kingdom hired the multinational firm Gorvis to a $10 million contract just 3 months after Jamal Khashoggi's death in 2018, in a bid to improve its image and reputation. Citing the failure of the Saudi crown prince and de facto ruler of the country, who has presented himself as a reformer to Western governments, Andrea Prasso, the deputy Washington director at Human Rights Watch, said Riyadh used lobbyists to whitewash its image in Washington. U.S. President Joe Biden has vowed to be tougher on Saudi Arabia than former President Donald Trump, who bragged about protecting Mohammed bin Salman in the aftermath of the Jamal Khashoggi murder. Several intelligence agencies, including the Central Intelligence Agency, the CIA, have reportedly concluded that Mohammed bin Salman personally ordered Jamal Khashoggi's killing. Riyadh has denied the accusations. Saudi Arabia's human rights record has come under intense scrutiny following the murder of the Saudi dissident and famous journalist Jamal Khashoggi. Separately, amid a brutal crackdown led by the Saudi Crown Prince against pro-democracy activists, Muslim preachers and intellectuals in the Saudi Kingdom, a Swiss-based human rights organization, has called upon the United Nations to intervene and secure the release of distinguished dissidents in Saudi Arabia, including the cleric Sheikh Salman Al-Ouda. Al-Karama asked the Committee on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities to pursue the case of Sheikh Salman Al-Ouda and urged independent experts to visit the imprisoned 64-year-old clergyman to examine him and report on his medical condition and needs. The cleric's son, Abdullah, wrote in a post published on his official Twitter page recently, "The human rights organization called on the United Nations body to intervene and urge Saudi authorities to release the prominent scholar, Dr. Salman Al-Ouda, who was arbitrarily detained, and stop the reprisals against his family members." The Arabic-language Saudi newspaper Okaz reported on 4th of September 2018 that the Saudi public prosecutors had leveled 37 counts against Sheikh Salman Al-Ouda and even demanded his execution. Saudi authorities detained a prominent Muslim scholar, Sheikh Salman Al-Ouda, on 7th of September 2018 and have been holding him in solitary confinement without charge and without trial ever since. Saudi officials have also imposed a travel ban on members of his family. A family member told Human Rights Watch that the distinguished cleric was being held over his refusal to comply with an order by Saudi authorities to tweet a specific text to support the Saudi-led blockade of Qatar. The US-based human rights group Human Rights Watch said in a statement, Al-Ouda instead posted a tweet saying, "May God harmonize between their hearts for the good of their people," an apparent call for reconciliation between Qatar and Saudi Arabia. Earlier this month, Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain and Egypt signed a declaration on the eve of the Persian Gulf Cooperation Council, PGCC, Leaders Summit in the ancient desert city of Al-Ula to ease a rift between Saudi Arabia and Qatar, signaling the end of a three and a half years of embargo of energy-rich Persian Gulf country. In June 2017, the four countries, Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, Bahrain and Egypt, accused Qatar, among other things, of supporting terrorism and having close ties to the Islamic Republic of Iran, and severed economic and diplomatic ties with Qatar. A blockade was also imposed by the four countries on Qatar by land, sea and air. Qatar has repeatedly denied the claims and said there was no justification for severing of relations. Also, a court in Saudi Arabia has sentenced a Shia Muslim eulogist to 9 months imprisonment as the Riyadh regime continues its heavy-handed crackdown on members of the Shiite religious community in the kingdom. The London-based and Arabic-language Nabah television network reported that a court of law in the city of Dammam, located about 400 kilometers east of Saudi Arabia's capital city of Riyadh, passed the ruling on Mohammed Boujabara, a Shia Muslim eulogist, for practicing religious rites. The same court also imposed 4-month prison sentence against 5 other defendants. On 4th of October 2020, the Saudi regime forces arrested Mohammed Boujabara and 8 other Saudi citizens in the Al-Asfa neighborhood of the Shiite-populated region of Al-Ahsar in Saudi Arabia's eastern province, as they were commemorating Arba'een, the 40th day after the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, the third infallible successor to Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Meanwhile, the European Saudi Organization for Human Rights has denounced the prison sentence handed down to Saudi Shia Muslim eulogist and his associates, voicing concerns about the dire situation of religious freedom in Saudi Arabia and spread of extremism in the country. The European Saudi Organization for Human Rights slammed the arbitrary arrest of Mohammed Boujabara and said the imprisonment and charges of exercising religious rights violates international law. Saudi Arabia has stepped up politically motivated arrests, prosecutions and convictions of peaceful dissident writers and human rights campaigners, in particular in Saudi Arabia's eastern province. The province has been the scene of peaceful demonstrations since February of 2011. Protesters have been demanding reform in Saudi Arabia, freedom of expression, the release of political prisoners in the country, and an end to economic and religious discrimination against the oil-rich region. The protests have been met with a heavy-handed crackdown by the Saudi authorities. In January of 2016, Saudi authorities executed the prominent Shia cleric, Sheikh Namr Baghir al-Namr, who was an outspoken critic of the Riyadh regime. Sheikh Namr Baghir al-Namr had been arrested in Qatif, also in eastern province of Saudi Arabia, in 2012.
In one of the Trump administration's final acts, the United States has labeled Yemen's Houthi movement, or Ansar Allah, as a foreign terrorist organization. This label has serious implications for a country that is already suffering greatly from years of war and genocide at the hands of the Saudi-led coalition supported by the West. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. Since 2015, Yemen has been gripped by war. The Houthi movement, also known as Ansar Allah, has been fighting against the Yemeni government, backed by a Saudi-led coalition, which includes the United Arab Emirates and Qatar. The country has also been plagued by the presence of Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, which has taken advantage of the war-torn country to wreak havoc. It's important to note here that the Saudi-led coalition has enjoyed tremendous support from the West in its bombing campaign of Yemen. For many years, the United States has sold astronomical amounts of weaponry to the Saudi kingdom, effectively supporting its relentless bombing campaigns in Yemen after gaining air supremacy over the country. Since Barack Obama took office, in a series of deals, he has sold Saudi Arabia roughly $115 billion worth of weapons, including other military equipment and training. Over 40 different deals, including tanks, warships, helicopters, and much more. When Donald Trump took office after him, he not only maintained U.S. support for the war in Yemen, but also increased arms exports to Saudi Arabia. In 2017, Trump set up one of the largest arms deals in history, which over 10 years would amount to up to $350 billion in weapons for the Saudis. Even until the very last minute in December of 2020, Trump was still pushing arms deals to the Saudis as his term was about to end. The United Kingdom has also played its part in this terrible genocide. Weapons manufacturers like BAE Systems and Raytheon UK make bombs in the United Kingdom, which they then sell to Saudi Arabia to be used in Yemen. According to John Devereaux, a former defense attaché to Saudi Arabia and Yemen, he said they couldn't do it without us, highlighting the instrumental role that Britain plays in fueling this genocide against the Yemeni people. The United Kingdom has also provided thousands of contractors who give in-country training to the Saudis. And as we recently learned, the UK has provided training to 100 Saudi Arabian pilots directly at Air Force bases inside of Great Britain. Simultaneously, France and Germany have also sold billions of weapons to the Saudi Arabian regime, raking in enormous sums and profiting off of the misery and destruction of Yemen. All of this combined has actually made Saudi Arabia the world's largest importer of weapons and, frankly speaking, the largest exporter of terrorism. Just from these bombs alone, thousands of civilians have already been killed. In one instance, 130 civilians were massacred in an airstrike while attending a wedding in 2015. Cluster bombs have continued to kill and maim innocent children. Human Rights Watch and other NGOs and relief agencies have noted the Saudi-led coalition's continued pattern in bombing fishing boats and fishing villages, which are civilian targets and constitute war crimes. In addition to weapon sales, we've also seen the U.S. intervene directly in the conflict, carrying out aerial bombardments and drone strikes. During his tenure, Obama was dubbed the drone striker in chief due to how many civilians were killed in his horrific drone program. At one point, he even ordered a drone strike which killed a U.S. citizen of Yemeni descent who was 16 years old. When pressed about the incident, his top advisor justified the killing by saying the boy should have had a more responsible father. Then when Donald Trump took over, he murdered the same boy's sister in another operation. Trump continued to support the war in Yemen, dropping even more bombs than Obama did during his time in office. This shows us that one feature all U.S. presidents seem to have in common is the disregard for human life and a love for the military-industrial complex. While a lot of the deaths in this conflict are the result of military operations, many of them have been the result of malnutrition, disease, and other preventable conditions, which makes it all the more heartbreaking. The United Nations warned that since the conflict broke out in 2015, conditions in the country have steadily collapsed, resulting in internal displacement, food insecurity, and cholera outbreaks. A report from the United Nations Humanitarian Office put Yemen's death toll at 233,000, mostly from indirect causes. According to the OCHA, the war had already caused an estimated 233,000 deaths, including 131,000 from indirect causes such as lack of food, health services, and infrastructure. Hostilities have directly caused tens of thousands of civilian casualties. Over 3,000 child deaths and over 5,000 children were verified in the first 5 years of the conflict, and 1,500 civilian casualties were reported in the first 9 months of 2012. As numerous NGOs and relief agencies have described the crisis in Yemen as the worst humanitarian situation in the world. In July 2020, according to the International Committee of the Red Cross, almost two-thirds of Yemenis do not have food, and around the same amount have no health care. Equally, they warned that a majority of Yemenis are without clean water, and 11% suffer from acute malnutrition. Already in 2017, it was noted that the cholera outbreak in Yemen was the largest ever recorded in history, with over 1 million cases. According to UNICEF, 12.2 million children are in need of humanitarian aid, and 24 million people are in need, but aid agencies can barely keep up as their funding goals aren't being met. As a result of this, the United Nations had to shut down several essential clinics, with more at risk of being closed. Lisa Grande, humanitarian coordinator for Yemen, said in August 2020 that half of all the UN's major programs in Yemen are impacted by this lack of funding. Already 12 of the UN's 38 major programs are shut or drastically reduced. These last years of wars have taken a tremendous toll on the Yemeni population. The Bush administration destabilized the Middle East with its war on terror. Then Obama and Trump took over, lending their military and logistical support to the Saudi-led coalition and even participating in this massacre of the Yemeni people. And on top of it all, what does the U.S. regime do